of our next panel, which is called Is Ours a Petro-Democracy? Gerald Butts is currently a director of the Trudeau Center for Peace and Conflict Studies at the Monk School of Global Affairs and the senior advisor to federal Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. Prior to that, he was the president and CEO of the World Wildlife Fund Canada and principal secretary to former Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty. He's both a McGill alumnus and currently on McGill's Board of Governors. Thank you for joining us here today, Mr. Butts.
The cheapest applause are always the ones you get before you say anything. It's really great to be here. We have a terrific panel, and I'm going to dispatch my responsibilities really quickly. I'm going to assume that you have read all of the bios of the terrific people we've got coming up, so I'm just going to read you a very short version of them and not go through them all. Thank you, by the way, for the introduction. It's really great to be invited to moderate this panel. I used to speak on these panels a lot when I was president of WWF. These days, I don't speak very much in public, but I find these conferences incredibly informative and worthwhile. So congratulations to Desiree and the whole gang of Put It Together. This is a very critical issue for the country, and having a reasonable and sometimes entertaining, I think as we did this morning, conversation about it is really important. So I have three terrific people on the panel with me today. Trish Audette is a journalist, and Trish, can you come on up and join us? I'm not going to go through your long and accomplished bio. I think you'll let your presentation speak for itself. Darren Barney, where's Darren, Professor Barney? He's a professor here at McGill. He's the Canada Research Chair in Technology and Citizenship and a professor at the Department of Art History and Communication Studies. I was an English student here when I was here 20 years ago, and communications was with English Lit then, but it's been annexed by art history, I guess. And Mary Janigan, who's a journalist and author, and whose book, the title, I get to say these words, Let the Eastern Bastards Freeze in the Dark, ought to be mandatory reading for anybody who ever gets involved in Canadian politics, especially if, like myself and a couple of other people in the audience, native Cape Bretoner, I am one of those Eastern bastards. It's very, very worthwhile reading because it not only talks about the issue, how it developed through the 70s and 80s, but takes you way back to the genesis of the issue in the post-First World War period. So with that, I think, Trish, you are first. I'm going to hand it over to you, and you can either speak from the table or take the podium, whatever makes you more comfortable.
I'll stay at the Trish, table. So when we actually had a chance to talk about this question, is ours a petro-democracy, I said that I was sort of struggling with it, and part of that is because there's a glib answer to it, right? There's a really glib answer that, at least in Alberta, a province that I called home for 7 years, we talk about having entered a fifth consecutive decade with the same political party in charge, and we can offer a quick list of examples, which we've kind of heard over the last couple of days. Adding to the more than 40 years of one-party rule in Alberta, we would note, as journalist Andrew Nikiforuk points out, that Alberta is among the lowest voter turnouts in the country during provincial elections. We would look to recent history, just 1995, when Alberta's oil sands underwent a public relations makeover, thanks to a national task force that brought together industry and government officials. Its members felt, as a later Pembina Institute report recounts, that the term tar sands sounded too, quote, dirty, and it was time for Canada's national prize to have a better name. We might map the routes personnel take between government and the energy industry, or the routes of political donations, or note Alberta's previous environment minister's routes in the energy industry. And in December, she became energy minister. But when I think of my friends and former colleagues in Alberta, as well as the passionate political activists I've known, be they conservatives or members of the NDP, or people who have been responsible for pulling together brand new parties in the last 6 years, I can't help but think that the story Albertans tell themselves about themselves and the state of their democracy is more nuanced. And many would just as glibly, as we also heard today, argue that a petro-democracy exists somewhere else. They would say that in those other places there are no democratic freedoms of expression or of association. They would say that in those places you can't publish writing that criticizes the governing party and its failures to meet international climate change goals or to draw out long-term respectful plans for temporary foreign workers. In these places, you don't know how the provincial justice system mets out creative sentences that see oil companies putting money toward everything from wetland restoration programs to community college scholarships as penance for breaking environmental laws. And so I think there is something really productive about this conversation, about this question, which suggests yes or no, but which begs a juxtaposition of experiences and observations to make us not go glib, not yes or no. I know that this question is actually meant to draw out to the rest of the country, not just Alberta, and I do want to come back to this to some extent, but as a former environment reporter and a former political reporter and a former crime reporter in Alberta, and now someone who lives in Montreal and thinks a great deal about how First Peoples express positions related to the oil sands and to oil pipelines, I have to admit that most of my time is spent sort of thinking critically about the Alberta experience or the Alberta state of democracy. So also when I came to this question, I reflected on my first year in Alberta when I received, Ralph Klein was premier then, and he was quite popular, and every Albertan, including myself, received a $400 check in the mail. It was our direct share of the province's oil wealth. It was one time only. I don't remember how I spent the money, but it was ostensibly intended for Albertans to stimulate an already fairly stimulated economy with a short-term buying spree. And that check was the first thing that I thought of as I read a 2001 paper written by Michael Ross in investigating whether oil hinders democracy. And Ross suggests that a sign of the oil impedes democracy claim can be when, quote, resource-rich governments use low tax rates and patronage to relieve pressures for greater accountability, close quote. Anyway, Ralph Klein, or some called him King Ralph, was the third in a progressive conservative dynasty that today spans five premiers. The party first came to power in 1971 when Peter Lougheed was elected premier, a change in government often associated with the province's prosperity churn, as well as Alberta's break from its past, what political insider Rich Favone has described as the, quote, cloud of pervasive religious moralism that had been a core value of the social credit government since 1935, close quote. For the purposes of discussing petrodemocracies, I'm interested in trying to unpack a discursive process that seems to equate the governing party to oil development, to sustaining Alberta's identity, to building the province's future. And so just taking on one moment in recent history that brought Albertans together, we might consider media reports produced after Peter Lougheed's death in 2012. Many of the reports emphasize not just his role securing Alberta's prosperity, but the extent to which he was both a private and public father figure. For example, CTV News dubbed Lougheed the father of Alberta, while a Calgary Herald story described him as a, quote, political titan, a staunch defender of Alberta, who ultimately transcended the province's boundaries to become a leader on the national stage, while always making time for each of his own four children, close quote. Engaging this meeting point, not just of prosperity and economic sustainability, but family and community values, gives us some room to try and magnify the feelings of collectivity that emerge in Alberta, and that politics, sort of oil politics produced in Alberta, such that opposition voices can be silenced as anti-Albertan, or I suppose against the family. This is not to say, however, that there are no voices of opposition, or that every Albertan internalizes and accepts narratives that tie the province's future to oil, or the way that oil is currently developed. So I want to end with sort of three possibly positive things. One is there are Albertans, including provincial government employees and other people with clout who look outside the province and outside the country for more than strategies just to clean up the province's images, but also to find out more about how other maybe petrodemocracies like Norway work and how they do things better. How is money saved better? How might Alberta move away from an unsustainable reliance on oil? Another side of resistance is the Pembina Institute, although they would never describe themselves, I don't think, as they certainly wouldn't say anti-tar sands, but they also wouldn't describe themselves as anti-oil sands. The consistency, though, with which the National Environmental Think Tank illuminates concerns and solutions has won it great attention and respect, and it's worthy to remember that it emerged in 1985 as a direct response to local residents in the area of Drayton Valley, Alberta, which is a small-ish oil community from which the current energy minister comes. There had been a sour gas blowout that killed two people and prompted for those residents a need for further investigation and research into the environmental impacts that sour gas pollution and other kinds of energy-related pollution produced. And that's where we see the Pembina, or that's sort of the birth of the Pembina Institute. Last of all, downstream, and we've talked about this a bit today as well, but finally, downstream of the bitumen extraction sites, First Nations at Fortship 1 are actively pursuing court cases to curb further development while maintaining a constant media offensive to ensure people outside their community do not forget its high rates of cancer or that it is still there. They have allies across Alberta and British Columbia, where First Peoples and others have protested the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline and will continue to do so. They've also, obviously, recently found allies in the likes of Neil Young or James Cameron, and across the border in the United States, First Peoples who are now protesting the Keystone XL Pipeline. So I'm going to end there with pipelines and kind of pass
Thanks
on.
Very much. Darren, you're up. I'll let you go right away.
Thanks. So my remarks today are going to concern the manner in which certain rhetorics of nationalism, economic nationalism, national identity, and technological nationalism have been mobilized by Canadian economic and state elites in an attempt to manufacture consent for the private exploitation of petrochemical resources in Canada, and in particular Alberta's oil sands. And I want to suggest that this effort has served to radically undermine the possibility of opening the political space in which we might begin to surmount the impasse that Imre Zeman described yesterday. So, according to the Alberta Department of Energy, and this is a quotation, only 13% of the world's oil is accessible to private investment. The rest is controlled by national governments. Of this accessible oil, 51% is found in Alberta's oil sands. So this is the basic material fact driving the imperative to develop the oil sands. There exists in the Athabasca region a massive collective resource that is distinguished first and foremost by its availability for private appropriation. This was confirmed by Jim Prentice, former Conservative Minister of the Environment, later Vice President of CIBC, who in 2012 made the rounds promoting the oil sands and pipeline development in a series of high-profile speeches, referring to what he described as Canada's enormous untapped resource wealth. He added, "And the best news of all is that all this development can be led by the private sector." It's instructive to note that Prentice specifically framed the good news of this unrivaled opportunity for private exploitation of a common resource as a matter of nation building. Now, in doing so, Prentice was just one among very many state and industry voices that have sought to justify private exploitation of the oil sands by attaching it to a national interest, to national identity, to a national imperative. The need for this would seem to arise from a second material fact that's particular to the bitumen of the Alberta oil sands, and that is that both its investment value and its exchange value depend on moving it from the point of its extraction to the point of its refinement and consumption. And moving it cost-effectively depends on an infrastructure that largely does not yet exist. So from the perspective of the transnational energy industry and its domestic partners, if the oil sands availability for private appropriation is the good news, then this is definitely the bad news. And it's bad news for them because the need to build an infrastructure to move this commodity to market means that what otherwise might have been the methodical unfolding of a beautiful little piece of extractive capitalism now must endure exposure to the uncertainties of political contestation. Pipelines traverse disputed territories and waters and habitats that are diversely populated with peoples and creatures and things, which have multiple and complicated claims on the impact of those pipelines and the substances that they carry, including their impact on climate change, claims that place them at odds with the interests of the energy industry. And wherever there's a scene of political contestation, there is uncertainty. And for all their loose talk of innovation and risk-taking, one thing is certain: capitalists hate uncertainty. And that's where nationalism comes in. For the great hope is that somehow this political scene that's been materialized by these pipeline projects can be contained or reduced or managed by attaching the force of national interest, national imperative, and national identity to the project of capitalizing on the oil sands. This is a political project, but it's also depoliticizing in the sense that it casts development of the oil sands as a self-evident collective good whose pursuit is beyond reasonable dispute, thus closing down the space in which those who think otherwise might make claims to a different future. Now, the nationalism that's been mobilized by state and industry elites in relation to the development of the oil sands and its pipelines has taken three forms. And actually, the more I think about it today, I see that there is a fourth form, this kind of smug, sexist, and racist nationalism, but that's already been covered today, so I'm going to leave that one aside. The first one that I want to talk about has been the ongoing effort to represent the economic benefits of oil sands development as significantly socialized. Right? It would be very difficult to win consent for such an environmentally dangerous enterprise if the case rested on the fact that its economic benefits will flow disproportionately to a relatively small number of private corporations, many of which are not even Canadian. This explains the massive effort undertaken to demonstrate that the economic benefits of the oil sands will fall to all Canadians in the form of investment, jobs, and public revenues. In the public discourse of oil sands and pipeline proponents, these benefits are presented as self-evident, as an historic opportunity of such a magnitude as to place the enterprise beyond the reach of reasonable opposition. This is what licensed the broad range of provisions that we heard about earlier today in the omnibus legislation attached to the 2012 federal budget aimed at reducing regulatory, political, and environmental burdens on oil sands and pipeline development, recent changes to the National Energy Board pipeline approval process that reduced the range of stakeholders permitted to participate, and also the increasing tendency of state and industry officials to brand anyone who opposes these developments as an enemy alien, as foreigners, as radicals who are a threat to the national interest and therefore not legitimate parties to what gets called the conversation. However, despite efforts to characterize the economic benefits of oil sands development as national, the degree to which the rewards of exploiting this resource will be socialized is contestable at best. Right? And this is due to many factors: the privatization of the resource, the massive presence of foreign capital in the oil patch, the export orientation of the industry, the underdevelopment of domestic secondary processing capacity, concentration of benefits in the province of Alberta, the comparatively low rates of resource royalty and taxation in that province, the low rate of employment intensity in the energy sector, the inflationary tendency in oil-related job creation projections, and the temporary character of energy development jobs. All of these cast the claim that the economic interest in developing the oil sands and related infrastructure is effectively national in a very dubious light. If there's anything national about the interest in oil sands development, it's the socialized distribution of the risks and costs, financial, environmental, democratic, reputational, associated with the extraction of this resource. So the claim that oil sands development represents an irresistible national economic interest is more unstable than its proponents would have us believe, which perhaps explains why they've sought to bolster it with appeals to two other forms of nationalism, both of which have an established track record in Canada. The first is that sort of cultural nationalism that seeks to identify Canadians with the exploitation of natural resources as the very fabric of our being. This was voiced perfectly by Jim Prentice in a speech at a 2012 meeting of the Business Council of British Columbia. He said, "We should take pride in who we are and what we do. We extract resources from our abundant natural deposits and rely on the proceeds of those sales to help provide an exceptional standard of living. We're blessed in every sense to profit as much as we do. We do it better than anyone in the world." Now, no one would deny that the extraction of staple resources for the benefit of foreign and domestic capital has definitely shaped the political economy of this country. But expressing this as definitive of our national identity accomplishes something in excess of simply stating that as a historical fact. It's specifically depoliticizing, insofar as it seeks to foreclose the possibility of a different country with an alternative future. To say that we should consent to a massive extractive enterprise whose economic benefits are concentrated and whose ecological dangers will be widely shared simply because it is who we are and what we do is to suggest that we cannot be or do otherwise. And it's to relieve those undertaking the enterprise of moral responsibility for their choices and their actions. And of course, the other thing is that this extractive national identity excludes from the body of the nation all those who have been and continue to be victims of the political economy it represents, and all those who never did and do not now see their interests and experiences reflected in it. It envisions an identity defined by the exclusion of environmentalists, many of whom are our own sons and daughters, many indigenous peoples, climate change activists, many ranchers and farmers, people who live along pipeline routes, the caribou and the orca, our friends and neighbors, all of whom look and sound as Canadian as the next person. If these, right, if the intelligent and articulate and passionate young people of Divest McGill are not part of who we are and what we do, then perhaps it's time to ask who we are and what we're doing. Right? So this extractive nationalism has been supplemented by a third sort, one that's been raised particularly in support of proposals to build east-west pipeline infrastructures that will traverse the country laterally. This sort of technological nationalism has a very long history in Canada, whereby lateral infrastructures built to facilitate national and imperial commerce are credited with binding the nation, both materially and ideologically. The CPR is, of course, the paradigmatic example of an infrastructural project to which we've attributed the realization of the nation itself. Technological nationalism has long been an effective means of collapsing the differences that actually make up the country and orienting these to some sort of common purpose that isn't necessarily all that common. The attachment of technological nationalism to the oil sands pipelines thus falls into a kind of familiar pattern, but it differs in a very crucial respect. In most of the previous episodes of technological nationalism in Canada, the common obstacles that had to be overcome to materialize the nation by force of infrastructure were geographical, the country's great expanse, its daunting rivers, its prairies, its mountains. But these days, the obstacle faced by those seeking to build an infrastructure that will traverse the country to facilitate commercial circulation are not primarily geographical. The primary obstacles are political. Right? The problem is not that the country is not bound spatially. The problem is that, as the ongoing contest over the development of the oil sands would suggest, it's not bound politically, in the belief that this enterprise is so clearly in the national interest and so clearly expressive of our national identity that building the infrastructure to support it is a self-evident national imperative beyond all debate. It's this geography of political difference, not the geography of the land or the waters, that the energy industry and its representatives must overcome in order to realize their new national dream. Now, this is no doubt what former Premier of New Brunswick and now Deputy Chair of the TD Bank, Frank McKenna, had in mind when advocating on behalf of the Energy East pipeline project that would bring Alberta bitumen to the Irving refinery in St. John, suggested that such a project would serve to deflate opposition to oil sands development. He said a national pipeline would put the issue beyond dispute. Now, we heard several times yesterday that the major problem with the current situation vis-a-vis the oil sands is that it's become too politicized. This is the fear right, to which the very political campaign to absorb our complex differences over energy development into the sponge of Canadian nationalism responds. But if we truly are at the impasse that Imre Zeman describes, marked by an apparently insurmountable gap between what we know and what we can bring ourselves to do, then what we need is not less, but more politics. At least if politics means what I think it does, which is an open contest between alternative claims to a shared future. This is the type of politics we need, and it's the type of politics that appeals to Canadian nationalism seek to talk us out of. But there's one more thing that I want to say in closing about these strategies. They are desperate, and they are failing. And that, I suppose, is really the best news of all.
Despite three temptations to try and drink your water, I didn't. Mary, tough act to follow. It's in your hands.
I object, thank you, Darren. I objected to the title. And my book agent called me and told me to get the nuns off my back. So I've been carrying this book title around and I can't even say it. So, anyway, thank you for having me here. I wrote a history book because I wanted to know why the Western provinces appeared to be so angry and so defensive about their natural resource wealth. I rolled back time to the mid-19th century when Ottawa acquired the vast western territories of Rupert's Land and the Northwestern Territory from the Hudson's Bay Company. Ottawa wanted a colony of immigrant farmers, so it kept control of the lands, minerals, forests, mines, and water within those territories, and it collected the revenues. Ottawa retained this constitutional control of the West natural resources even after it had carved provinces out of those lands. Western territorial and provincial governments, including Louis Riel's provisional government, fiercely resisted. All other governments, all other provinces, controlled their resources and their resource revenues. So Western governments wanted constitutional equality, and they fought for decades to obtain that control. It's a story that I teased out from the archives. One major insight of the book comes from the subtitle. Originally, it was going to be the West versus Ottawa. That's what I thought I was going to find. But as I tracked the very uncivil battles across the decades, I realized it was the West versus the rest of Canada, including Ottawa. Every time the Prairie provinces demanded resource control, the other premiers retorted that their taxpayers had paid 300,000 British pounds for the Hudson Bay Company to extinguish their rights to the land. So they owned the resources. If the West received resource control, they wanted something too. In particular, the Maritime Premiers and British Columbia wanted compensation for the central government's loss of ownership and revenues. It was a fierce fight. Quebec and Ontario also wanted more subsidies. It's fascinating. Anyway, it was the conflict that fostered strong regional identities. On one side were the Western premiers, who became enmeshed in a battle for provincial rights that was as fierce and as heartfelt as Quebec's struggle to protect its language and culture. I didn't know this. The Western provinces claimed that the resources were their patrimony. Their narrative was that Ottawa was making a profit from their resources and putting very little back into their societies. The rest of Canada claimed that the lands and the resources were a national heritage, and they needed the lands and the resources to supply farms to settlers who would buy central Canadian goods, to carve out paths for the railroads, and to herd First Nations into conveniently isolated reserves. On occasion, those positions could be reduced to the level of morality plays, but everybody saw themselves as the good guys. And this clash of visions continued across time. For decades, there was very little nuance, very little subtlety, and very little room for compromise, if only because Ottawa could not afford to buy peace. The discussions became very personal and very partisan and occasionally very abusive. It jumps out at you reading the records. You can scarcely believe that in official records this language was used. There was a fear the talks would go on forever. But even though the premiers changed across time, even though they embraced apparently irreconcilable principles in public, they remained, and this was all of them, tough, hard-nosed politicians who were fighting for their economic and political interests. There were many victims in the struggle. Manitoba Premier John Norquay, who was Scottish Métis, bravely told his voters that he would not settle for less than resource control. He was very fierce. He went to Ottawa, and he didn't get it. He actually came home with a better deal. He had higher subsidies. But because he had sold his vision so strongly, his voters turned on him, and he died a broken man. It's an interesting tale. As Imre Zeman pointed out yesterday, cultural assumptions are very, very difficult to shift. You can see them today. Eventually, the Western premiers and the rest of Canada settled when the ongoing cost of the strife, coupled with Ottawa's newfound cash, ensured that it was more profitable for everyone to settle than feud. Analysts have looked at the relationship between oil-rich states and levels of democracy using economic indices. It's a very narrow vision. That cash often comes from foreign individuals, concerns, or governments, to quote economist Hussein Madevi, and usually few citizens are involved in the generation of resource wealth. Those states tend to be much less democratic, as Trish pointed out, because they do not need to tax their citizenry heavily. They can spend lavishly on patronage and social programs. They can thwart the formation of opposition groups. They can afford more security to quell dissent. And large chunks of their workforce are not specialized. So, I mean, on the surface, this doesn't include Canada. We've heard the statistic that only 6% of our GDP is involved in the generation of oil and gas. But I'm going to suggest we look beyond the economic indicators. We should trace the political, social, and cultural influences of the past on the present national debate. I maintain that almost 150 years of squabbling over resource control and revenues have ensured that the issue does have an effect on how democracy works. Past petroleum issues have also fueled the vehemence of the debate. I'm so sorry. Today's discussions are not only about the huge environmental and economic issues of development. They are also entangled in these ongoing narratives of provincial rights and Aboriginal rights and regional identities and what constitutes the rest of Canada's best interests, including Ottawa's best interests. The past has seemingly paralyzed many players who are wary of repeating this devastating history. May I pull out 5 short references to how the past, I can see it in the present, as real as if the ghost of Louis Riel was speaking in his legislature. First of all, the title of the session yesterday was Who Owns Our Oil? It's apparent that portions of the rest of Canada still have these ideas of control over Western resources. Citizens of the rest of Canada, I'm talking about ownership, by the way, I'll get to environment. Citizens of the rest of Canada do not demand the same say over fracking in Quebec or hydropower in Quebec or hydropower in Newfoundland and Labrador. This is an historical remnant, a bread-in-the-bone attitude that was on display after Ottawa lost its bid to obtain a greater share of Western resource wealth through its corporate income taxes. The National Energy Program tried to shift development from the provinces to the territories so Ottawa could get a bigger revenue share. Number two, obviously the Alberta-based Prime Minister is aware of this history of the struggle over provincial resource rights. In the past, Ottawa largely represented the interests of central Canadians in this battle over Western resource rights. Ottawa now identifies the national interest and its national interests with the West. As Matthew Mendelssohn would say yesterday, this is a dangerous game to be playing, to be sending off regions against each other. Ironically, the federal government's past record of intrusions on behalf of central Canada is hobbling any action to ameliorate climate change. Although the environment is an area of shared constitutional jurisdiction, the federal government has delayed the tabling of regulations to curb oil and gas emissions. This is not so much an economic decision as a political strategy. The past has paralyzed the Prime Minister, and he has not prepared the federal government for the change that's taking place in our culture, in our body politic. He has not got the citizenry ready for federal action on this issue. Indeed, everything he's done has made it harder for Ottawa. I don't want to personalize that, but everything the Conservative government has done has made it harder to take federal action. Similarly, there are Westerners who've urged Ottawa to take constitutional control of the Enbridge Gateway pipeline project for the general benefit, general advantage of Canada. You can do that in the Constitution, Section 9210A. And one of the things is you declare a project for the general advantage, and some Westerners, like Tom Flanagan, have said it should be taken over by the feds and pushed across. I think it's a really good idea that the past won't allow that either. But you do have premiers speaking to each other. Quebec's Pauline Marois, British Columbia's Christy Clark, Alberta's Alison Redford, Ontario's Premier, New Brunswick Premier, they're considering a carbon control strategy, although it's not at all clear that they'll reach a compromise. Ottawa, in this climate, should not be acting unilaterally. It should be working with the provinces. This carbon control strategy is supposed to come out in May, so we'll see. If not, then perhaps he has to start to change a climate that dates back to 1870. Third point, the virulence of the debate is incredible. If you sit here and watch it, it has resonance from other eras. You look at the personal attacks on Neil Young. You look at the petroleum producers or the politicians, how they're called personal names. This is not how we have a debate. It does reflect our heritage of interprovincial suspicion and perhaps even some jealousy. After all, Alberta will pocket more than $300 billion in royalties from the oil sands over the next 20 years. Ottawa cannot touch that revenue, but it is indirectly touching it and therefore upsetting all the other provinces, especially Ontario, because it increases equalization payments. Matthew Mendelssohn talked about the formula. The stability has gone further, I would argue, in these debates than the debates about Francophone language rights in the 1960s and 70s. Those who cannot deal with nuances should not hijack the discussions. Past resource issues were settled when there was civility. One premier, Frederick Haltane, he lost it in 1905. He couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't stand Sir Wilfrid Laurier not listening to him, so he began to call him names. He went on the road, and he supported Borden's opposition against the Liberals. It, of course, blew up any settlement, any possible settlement of the issue for another 20 years, 25 years. It was settled. The whole issue was settled when the premiers talked to each other with civility. Second last point. Resource revenue may be relatively minor in terms of the Canadian economy, but they represent 20% of the Alberta government's revenues. Alberta has no sales tax. It has a small carbon tax on excess emissions. Premier Redford is trying. She's moved Alberta toward the political center, and she is discussing the possibility of raising the carbon taxes. The energy companies are apparently prepared for this. Regional governments are discussing the issue. But there has to be, and I don't know why the politicians do not join this, there has to be a massive shift in the culture as well. You don't suddenly plunk a carbon tax on people. You prepare them. I think the public's ready for it. But you have to do that movement. Lastly, the problematic relationships between the First Nations and the oil and gas industry, you can trace it all through the past, starting actually with the tensions between the Métis of Louis Riel's time and the settlers he was dealing with. The English settlers. They were herded onto reserves, as the language of Treaty 8 says, so Ottawa could take the land for settlement, mining, trading, and other purposes. It's taken 180 Supreme Court cases to come closer to clarifying their position in these debates. I think that one of the reasons, and I'm sure the corporate culture has been embedded, even though the names change across the decades, across the centuries, this corporate culture has been embedded for forever. You just don't need to bother. And it's rather a disgrace. When I went on my book tour, I noticed that very few people asked about the history of the issue. No one wanted to know how Louis Riel, this was not his rebellion in 1885. What happened to him in 1870 that made him so upset, so determined to get these resources and resource rights? Instead, most people wanted to talk about the present. They were engaged. They wanted to be heard. Our ambivalent relationship with the nation's resources has become part of Canada's cultural narrative. I would suggest that petroleum issues have a substantial effect on the functioning of our democracy. There can be changes. The debate is broadened beyond the traditional players, despite the past and despite what Darren has explained, is the attempt to turn the debate into two sides, to turn it into people who are against the country and those who are the Canadian national project bearers. Perhaps only for the same cold, calculating reasons of self-interest that led their predecessors to eventually settle. The West and the rest, including First Nations, may be stumbling toward a compromise. This conference is a really good step on that route, I think. Thank you.
Yes.
excellent presentation. Mary, you said something that I thought could be the subtitle of A History of Canada, a morality play in which everyone sees themselves as the good guys. I thought that was a great line. That's your next book. So I'm going to open it up for questions. I think we have about, if we want to cut our coffee break short, we can take 10 minutes or so for questions. So.
Thank you.
Over here.
Hello, Felix Longaya. Some very eloquent stuff there, I must be honest. A couple of points. Darren, I've been thinking for some time that Harper's kind of eulogism of the North is, would you say it's kind of akin to a Nazi or German kind of blood and soil kind of approach with the nice sort of romanticism of Sir John Franklin and his valiant crew? But coming back to Mary, the interesting thing about the politics of Canadian oil is, like, in 1961, Washington basically told Ottawa that, you know, Alberta's going to supply Canada its petrol west of the Ottawa River, Venezuela's going to supply east of the Ottawa River, and it's only when we had the crisis after the Iranian Revolution that Trudeau came up with the National Energy Plan, and it was basically U.S. oil companies and Washington who lobbied him so hard that he had to abandon this. Now, if we go back to what Ezra Levant was saying earlier about ethical oil and this wonderful liberal democracy, which is somewhat in peril at the moment.
Could you please come to a question? I'm sorry. Yeah. I want to give other people a chance to ask a question.
I just want to ask you, if Washington could actually do that to a country like Canada, what could they actually do to the other nine countries that he was mentioning, which was he was then saying are not very ethical?
Please go ahead.
You answer me. Well, when I did look at what constitutes a petro-state, I realize that the influence of the American government has led to a lot of the formation of repressive governments around the world. For example, one of the essays I read that was the most pivotal, that used regression analysis just to look at economic factors and how states work, broadened the field beyond the traditional Middle East nations, to look at countries such as Nigeria, to look at what's going on in Mexico, countries that produce oil all over the world. And we see there the repression of democracy, partly because a large part of the government revenues are dependent upon foreign actors who are paying royalties, who are subsidizing communities, who are ensuring that those nations function. Without going on about it, it's clear that the influence is huge and it's continuing. As to Canada, I think that the present Conservative government is more a function, more crippled by the past than anything I've seen for years. I mean, perhaps I bring a central Canadian viewpoint to this. But it's so evident every time I hear this issue spoken about that the past has haunted the present. And nobody seems to have the willpower to move beyond where we're at to where we should be, to where we could be, to sell a different cultural area. I learned a lot yesterday from Emery Zeman's presentation. It was very helpful in terms of a paradigm.
Over to this side of the room.
Hi, my name is Howard Longley. I'm a PhD student at the University of Alberta. My question's for Darren, and that's, where would you place the historical emergence of this resource nationalism? Is it something that's reactionary to more recent environmentalism, or does it go deeper than that?
I mean, I think it's pretty old, right? It's received expression, I think, in multiple ways that aren't necessarily identical to what I talked about today, as, you know, in the service of domestic and transnational capital. We have a very long history of understanding ourselves as a staples economy and trying to kind of express the material impact that that kind of economic organization has had on cultural formations. There are ways in which people have tried to express that don't necessarily have anything to do with apologetics for whatever the current interests of industry might be. But in this case, there's
you know, a really good match between that that rhetoric that does have a long history in Canada and what can be mobilized right now in the service of what is, I think, a project that that most directly serves a fairly narrow range of interests.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I think it's very old. I grew up in Cape Breton Island and in a coal mining town. And I used to joke with friends from Alberta that I grew up in Fort McMurray. My hometown was Fort McMurray in 1795. I think this is a story that's been told over and over again with mixed endings at best.
Thank you.
Hi. My name is Lily Schwartzbaum. I'm a member of Climate Justice Montreal and Divest McGill. So I really valued in all of your comments the need for social and political shift to happen before we can actually get somewhere. And last year, actually, Divest McGill tried to use the power of McGill as a university to impact the social license of the fossil fuel industry by divesting from it, from the top 200 companies. And the Board of Governors rejected that petition with support of all three major student universities and over 1,000 signatures. So I was wondering, what do you think about that lost opportunity? And I would also be very interested in hearing from Gerald Butts, who sits on the Board of Governors.
Well, honestly, I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on that. We're going to have lots of opportunities to talk on campus about that. And I really don't want to hijack the conversation that we're trying to have here. But I appreciate the question. I'm happy to talk to you about it. We will have an open forum on campus about it.
I would just say, in the context of the presentation that I made, the kind of effort that Divest McGill is involved in is exactly the kind of serious disruptive type of politics that's going to be necessary to move the ideological and policy register on this issue. I don't think you get past, you don't talk your way past an impasse necessarily. I think that there's going to be some kind of disruption. Whether it's going to be a disruption that's enforced upon us by our inaction, or it's going to be a disruption that we undertake through action such as the ones that your group are organizing, is the only question. And so I really think that the level of change that's required has to start materially, and divestment, as difficult and thorny and complicated an issue as it is one of those kind of material levers that can serve to kind of shift discourse in a way that opens up a set of consideration of alternative possibilities. So I would say I applaud and support your efforts to convince this guy.
I'm excited to hear about that open forum.
Oh, sorry, this one on the other side.
Hi, my name is Nessa Gassami. I'm an environment student at McGill and also a member of Divest McGill. And so my question was, the question around the panel is surrounded around the issue of democracy. And so I was wondering what your thoughts were on the power of lobbying and of corporate interests playing into what we like to deem a democracy. Yeah, I want to try and take a run at that. Thank you for that question. I sort of hinted at it a little bit when I talked about trying to follow some of the roots of donations and political donations. And in Alberta specifically, most parties that are remotely successful have some level of political donation from oil companies. And it's really interesting to watch how those levels work, because you can literally see companies being like, this is going to be the winner, most money. This is going to be the second most, third most, and it kind of moves around like that. As to the lobbying, so I mean, Alberta really just brought in new legislation a couple of years ago, so people actually knew who was lobbying ministers and when, and it was like the first time that they actually, people started to try and think through what that meant and what the ramifications could be. I feel like I'm not quite answering your question, except for that I think that it's a really important thing to be aware of and to continue to be educated about and try to unpack and make as transparent as possible so that we can question it.
Thank you. I mean, one thing I would add is we heard this morning a presentation that laid out some numbers of the kind of radical disproportionality in access to key decision makers on these questions between entirely legitimate, long-standing, responsible representatives of the environmental and ecological movement and industrial representatives on the other side. So that's a structural attribute of the current political situation surrounding decision-making on these issues. It's not the only one. I mean, I mentioned a couple of figures in my talk today, former politicians who are now either working as, in industry representative positions or working on behalf of major banks that are heavily invested in petrochemical development. There's a kind of revolving door dynamic between the highest levels of state, the highest levels of the energy industry, and finance that also kind of locks in this disproportionate influence that has a decidedly corrosive effect on democratic possibility, and that in fact casts a lot of our kind of, you know, what we learn in school about freedom of expression and that every voice counts and that all you have to do is write a letter to your MP and your voice matters, etc., in a very dubious light. And it's precisely the undemocratic character of the way in which decisions are getting made around this issue that's locked in as structural, that forces other kinds of actions in order to get attention, in order to get voices heard, in order to get issues on the table that are otherwise structurally excluded by that arrangement.
I'm going to address your question directly because I think it's a really important one. And I guess I would differ a little bit from what Darren just said. I was the recipient of lobbying for 8 years in a major government in the country. And I think that we tend to too easily ascribe white and black hats in these discussions when the Occam's razor really applies here. The simplest explanation is usually the right one. We delivered the biggest carbon abatement project in the history of the country. We retired 7,500 megawatts of coal-fired energy in Ontario over the course of, well, the last one will be done next year. I believe that to be the case. I met with a lot of people who were supporting that policy and not with a lot of people who didn't. And I think that there's a bit of a chicken and egg discussion with lobbyists and the federal government. I think that lobbyists are, I've never been one, but they are just lawyers who advocate for their clients' interests at the legislative branch instead of the judicial branch. And as long as it's transparent and everybody knows what's happening, I think it's a perfectly acceptable activity in a democracy, as long as there's equal access and there's not a backdoor fundraising aspect to it.
Could I add one thing, just for a second? When Janelle Baker spoke this morning, I was really interested in how she spoke about things I never would have thought of. For example, that elders didn't want to use products from reclamation areas, which means that if you don't hear that group, you don't know this. And it was interesting to me that you didn't just exclude what you thought you knew and didn't need to hear again. You're actually excluding points of view that you don't know about, and it's a loss to all of us.
Yeah, I wasn't making a normative judgment, just so you know, Mary, I'm saying don't blame the lobbyists, blame the politicians.
I was, honestly.
Thank you. My name is Tara Davis. I'm a student here at McGill, and I want to address this question to Trisha Detlongo. First, I want to thank you for studying how First Nations and Métis communities in Alberta and British Columbia use media to express a variety of health, cultural, conservation concerns in connection to bitumen extraction. I want to ask you how these communities challenge industry's stance that they have invested in adaptive measures to help communities cope with the potential technological failure, such as a spill off the coast of BC, and is industry shifting the debate in such a way that these developments are inevitable and we as Canadians are left to just adapt? Do you see this mirroring the shift in climate change discourse from mitigation to adaptation? And if so, how and by what means are First Nations and Métis peoples expected to adapt to changing conditions in their climate?
That's a good question.
That's a great question.
It's a great question. And I don't know that I have the answer at this point. I'm sorry. I'm doing research, and that sounds like such a cop-out answer, but the research I'm endeavoring to do is with people to the extent that I can ask those questions of them as opposed to trying and speaking on behalf of them. And I know that sounds like a terrible cop-out, and I'm not trying to cop-out, but thank you for the question. Yeah.
If we get through the two, we can... We can ask everybody have a chance here. So, go ahead.
Oui, Jean Morisset, Université du Québec, à Montréal. I was wondering first if when Jacques Cartier was navigating up the Grand Rivière de Canada, the first name of the St. Lawrence, if he knew he would bump up 4 centuries later against petrodemocracy. That's the first wondering. Second wondering, I have heard only today the word "oh, democracy, democracy" at least 100 times. I sometimes teach in Brazil, Mexico, the Caribbean, exotic country, France, and I never hear the word democracy associated with Canada. I never hear the word like, there is a democracy up there. That doesn't exist, that expression doesn't exist. And hearing it so often, like 100 times, one wonders, if it were a democracy, it would not have to be used that much. My third wondering, I was living in Alberta and Couteau Jaune, Yellowknife, in 74, 73, just during the before the Berger inquiry. There was some, the bastards would, from Quebec would freeze in the dark. But from the eastern Canada, I don't know, Quebec is not eastern Canada, it's the base of Canada to start with. But my wonder is something else. At the time, I think the dream of Berger was to make a country, not to make a new country, to make a country. And at the time, you know, that dream of a trioceanic country, Arctic, Pacific, and Atlantic, was there. And now with the petrodemocracy, it is as if the Arctic est quelque part entre parenthèses. So that is my third wondering.
Anybody?
You don't have to answer.
Go ahead.
Nobody has
an answer. Point of act to follow. I'm sorry, I'll try to keep this really brief. But I'm also a historian background, and I'm currently doing research on the Trans-Canada pipeline debate that pretty much rocked Parliament in 1956. Sure. And brought the end of the Liberal government after 22 years in power over a bill which the Canadian government lent $1 billion to an oil company to build the pipeline from Alberta, just following the Leduc and major discoveries, to Ontario in that time period. And I just, Darren's talk really hit a lot of points in my research. I was just wondering if you're familiar with that topic and could elaborate more on that economic nationalism and the technological nationalism that goes along with these narratives. Sure. Because particularly in that time period, our whole environmentalist discourse and Aboriginal peoples were pretty much non-existent in that time period. So they were not part of the contentious issues around that pipeline.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would just say that I am familiar with that, that's an excellent, in the work that I've been doing on this, I take that as a kind of inaugural moment in, at least as far as technological nationalism getting attached to pipeline development is concerned. You're right. I mean, in that case, it was more the kind of nationalism that was hoping to somehow smooth over some of the the federalist tensions, and not necessarily about the kind of depoliticization vis-a-vis other kinds of oppositional forces that I'm talking about, that we talk about in this context. However, it is also the case that in that period, that nationalism, that form of that technological nationalist discourse absolutely made indigenous peoples disappear right in that moment. And that's, in a way, consistent with the functioning of this discourse, or at least the attempt that's being made by this discourse today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you to all the panelists. I thought it was a terrific discussion, and I think we have a short break.